How much ultra-processed food do you eat?
The obesity paradox.
Should we feed peanuts to all babies?
And transplanting incompatible kidneys.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on March 11th, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, we're going to apologize up front to all the folks who listen to us because, gosh, this week we're just like really focused on food. So on that note, I'd like to turn to the British Medical Journal. A look at American diets and how much of that diet is comprised by what they're calling ultra-processed foods.
Well, we've had a lot of policy attention focused on added sugars to food. This has not only been in the U.S., but in the United Kingdom and Canada and across Europe as well. Based upon reports generated from a number of different organizations, it's been noted that a high intake of added sugars to food increases the risk of weight gain, obesity, and type 2 diabetes, stroke, coronary heart disease, cancer, and even dental caries or dental cavities. So the recommendation is limiting added sugars to no more than 10% of our total calories should be our goal. Unfortunately, when you just look at the U.S. alone, the added sugars amount to about 15% of our total calories. So how do we limit it? Well, this was a very interesting study. It was a cross-sectional study looking at the NHANES data, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, conducted in 2009 and 2010, in which they evaluated over 9,300 participants that had recorded what they ate over the last 24 hours. And they looked at the types of food they ate and how much added sugar there was. They divided foods into four different categories, which I thought were interesting. One is unprocessed or minimally processed food. It's primarily raw foods like vegetables and fruits. Food that had processed culinary ingredients. Now, that's things like adding table sugar or oil or fat or salt or some other substance just to make it taste a little bit better. Then there were processed foods, foods manufactured, and it had added salt or sugar. And then this group I've not heard of before, the ultra-processed. Foods that have formulations, they were processed, but had formulations of several ingredients besides salt and sugar that added flavor or emulsifiers or different types of additives. What they discovered was that these ultra-processed foods comprised almost 60% of our energy intake and contributed 90% of the energy intake from added sugars. This suggests that decreasing the consumption of these ultra-processed foods could be one of the most effective ways to decrease our excessive intake of sugars in the United States.
Wow, isn't that incredible? So when I think about ultra-processed, I always use this metric. Could it survive the nuclear holocaust? And that is that it is so not found in nature that there would be no impact by all that ionizing radiation. I always think of things like cheese curls, or maybe you could give me some other examples.
Sure. In fact, you're right. These are oftentimes shelf-stable that could stay on for years. So they include things like soft drinks and fruit drinks, cakes and cookies and pie, salty snacks, frozen foods, pizza, even breakfast cereals. So those are considered the ultra-processed foods.
I wonder if the FDA then is, or the USDA is going to have to start including this ultra-processed label on foods.
You know, that's interesting. You picked this article, and it wasn't a term that I was familiar with, because we talk about unprocessed and processed, and I never talked about culinary ingredients processed, that is, added things that add the taste. But this ultra-processed was a brand new concept, and perhaps if we get people to think about it, we can actually get them to decrease their intake.
Well, just for the short term, I would say that when shopping, look for something that would be found in nature and consume that. Since we're talking about these sorts of dietary issues then, why don't we turn to the New England Journal of Medicine? It's the American Academy of Allergy and Immunology meeting time. This was a look at that recurring fave for everybody, including those who fly on Southwest, peanut allergy. What happens if we feed peanuts to children, to infants?
Well, in fact, Elizabeth, this is actually an extension of that study that you mentioned, what was called the LEAP study, which was previously reported. And we actually talked about that about a year ago. We noted that about 8% of infants in the United States have peanut allergy. It's common, and it's potentially a life-threatening food allergy. Sometimes kids have mild manifestations, sometimes as much as anaphylactic shock. What the LEAP study, the Learning Early About Peanut Allergy study, showed was that if infants were at high risk for allergy, that actually giving them peanuts in infancy dramatically decreased the rate of having serious allergies. It lowered the risk of peanut allergy by 81%. What follows up is, okay, let's say you do that for the first 5 years, and then if kids avoid peanuts over the next year, does the allergy reappear? And this is what this report is, where of the over 600 initial participants, they re-enrolled 556, or about 89% of them, and followed them over the year. Peanut allergy at 72 months was significantly more prevalent among kids that had never seen peanuts. About 18 or 19% of them had a peanut allergy, but those that had previously been exposed, it was down about 5%. And so that's a really important message.
It sure is, especially as kids, when they start to become voluntary consumers, may turn away from peanuts, especially if they've had a lot of exposure early in life.
Yep.
I guess caution, though, is still required, as we discussed in the original study. You just don't want to go out there and wholeheartedly give your child peanuts if you have a history of peanut allergy in the family.
Absolutely. So these were kids that were at high risk for developing it. That does need to be done under the supervision of a healthcare provider, so I'm glad you mentioned that.
Excellent. I think it's also worth noting that also in the New England Journal this week was another study relative to this topic. And then we also, one we chose not to discuss, was using hydrolyzed infant formula to look at whether that was also able to reduce the development of allergies. So lots of allergy stuff going on with kids. Let's turn from here then to Annals of Internal Medicine, since we're continuing our diet theme. What is the real factor relative to fat on our bodies and mortality?
So I introduced this as the obesity paradox, because there are some studies that suggest that being overweight or mildly obese is associated with decreased mortality. Now, we've spent a lot of time talking about how the right diet and exercise can improve survival, but this obesity paradox has been a little bit of an issue. When we talk about the obesity paradox, it's usually determined by looking at somebody's body mass index, or what's called their BMI. When you look at it, the BMI is really not a very good marker of someone's obesity. Fat is not inert. These cells still make something called cytokines that can increase inflammation. Fat has been associated with inflammatory conditions that lead to diabetes and hypertension. So how do you tease out whether it's a BMI or the fat? These investigators did an interesting thing. In Manitoba, Canada, they oftentimes have bone densitometry with what's called a dual energy X-ray absorptometry, or a DEXA scan. Well, that DEXA scan can measure the percentage fat as well. So in adults age 40 years or older who had been referred for bone mineral density testing, they had a cohort of over 50,000 individuals. Most women, they assessed what their body mass index was, and they also assessed how much adipose tissue or fat they had. Then they correlated that with mortality. Increased mortality was associated with a low body mass index, but a high body fat percentage. The more obese you are, the higher your mortality, the lower your BMI. You say, why would a low BMI be associated with mortality? Because those people oftentimes have chronic conditions. So increased adiposity, increased fat, not good for overall survival. Ideally, you'd like to have as minimal adipose tissue or fat as possible. And obviously, the more fit you are, the more improvement you have both in mortality or survival and in quality of life.
Good message. We like that one. Let's turn now back to the New England Journal of Medicine, something that is completing this whole picture we have about kidney transplant. Gosh, if you transplant a so-called incompatible kidney, what's the impact on people who receive that?
More than 32,000 people in the United States alone are awaiting kidney transplants. And we usually try to make sure that the kidney transplant recipient is matched to a person that's donating the kidney. The markers on the tissue are matched so to prevent rejection. Now, unfortunately, many of the people waiting for kidney transplant don't have good matches out there. And the options are this: continue on the waiting list, continue on dialysis, or we can give them a kidney that doesn't match very well, put them on immunosuppressive therapy, and see how well they do. The basis of this study was to say, okay, we have a bunch of people that received incompatible kidneys, weren't good matches. What is their survival compared to the other groups? And what they discovered in this 22-center study, looking at survival benefit in over 1,000 recipients of kidney transplants from kidneys that were not good matches, is that their survival was better in the people who received unmatched kidneys than it was in the other groups. By the way, that survival was better at 1 year, 3 years, at 5 years, at 7 years, even 8 years down the road. This may change the paradigm of people waiting for kidneys who don't have good matches out there.
And it's a really important take-home message, of course. We talked a little bit about how very onerous dialysis is for people who have to stay on it.
onerous in that it causes a very significant decrease in quality of life. You're at the dialysis center for usually half a day, 3 days a week. People are chronically tired, and it's associated with infections as well. Not only that, Elizabeth, but it's more expensive to be on dialysis than to get a kidney transplant. So what this study informs me is that even for individuals that don't have good matches, getting an unmatched kidney improves their survival, it will improve their quality of life, and societally, it's less expensive as well than keeping them on dialysis.
Good news all around.
So Elizabeth, which do you want to highlight on the blog this week?
I'm going to do the percentage of ultra processed foods that comprise our diet, because of course that's something that I'm very focused on. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live and eat well.